glad to be over safely from San Antonio. We have also been anticipating being able to be here. Several years ago, matter of fact, about 20 years ago, is when I made the decision, and Judy and I kind of collectively made a decision that we were going to dedicate a lot of our time to dealing with what the Bible says about marriage and about family. And I'll explain a little bit of that in a moment, but partially because we just weren't spending enough time, I don't think, amongst our brethren dealing with that subject, and we were watching what was happening because we weren't spending enough time dealing with that subject, as the things that were happening in the world, in our culture around us, and the attitudes toward marriage and the lack of devotion to marriage was bleeding over into the church, and we were reaping the results of not properly understanding some of the things that God said. So here's what we're going to do this morning in this class and in the lesson that follows. We're going to deal with some principles that I think are absolutely critical to get our mindset right, so that if the Lord permits us to meet again this evening and throughout the rest of the week as we intend, then we will deal with the practical side of that. How do I apply those principles today? How do I become the kind of husband that I'm supposed to become? What does that look like to become the kind of wife that you're supposed to become? What does that look like? And the reason I do it this way is I think this is the way God approaches virtually any subject that he deals with in our lives. He says, if I can get you to think the right things, have the right mindset, I can get you to follow that with the proper actions. In the book of Philippians, when Paul wrote that letter, some 10 different times, he deals with the idea of the mindset that we have, the things that we need to think about, the things that we need to meditate on, and then he helps us understand how to translate those proper mindsets into the actions of our lives. And so that's what we're going to do this morning as we deal with a lesson that is titled, Finding God in Your Marriage. And I think that's going to be the key. How do we understand what marriage is even all about? Socrates said, by all means, marry. If you get a good wife, you'll become happy. If you get a bad one, you'll become a philosopher. I'm sure that speaks something as to his marriage relationship. But is that what it's all about? Is that what's going to determine it? And is happy really what it is that I'm striving for? I'm not saying marriage shouldn't provide happiness, but we'll talk about that as a goal in a moment. I like this quote better. This is from Gary and Betsy Ricucci. They've written some books on marriage. They said, one of the best wedding gifts God gave you was a full-length mirror called your spouse. Had there been a card attached, it would have said, here's to helping you discover what you're really like. So I would ask you this question, just for a show of hands. And don't volunteer the information, just a show of hands. How many of you, after you got married, found out something about your spouse that you did not know before you got married? All right, and how many are just not willing to answer that question because there were not enough hands up? We did. We found out things about our spouse. And not all of them were good. I found out great things. My wife found out great things. But she found out I had some habits and some characteristics that she probably didn't understand that I had before. And not all of them fall into the favorable category. But here's the more important question. How many of you have found out since you've gotten married something about yourselves that you might not have realized before? Yeah, that really is the key. And that's what this quote is about. There's a guy by the name of Gary Thomas that wrote a book called Sacred Marriage. And in that book, he said he got voted in ninth grade. He was voted most polite kid in his class. Do you remember those awards? I didn't get any of them, but I remember them conducting them. Most polite, most likely to succeed, you know, those types of things. And so he said, I got most polite kid. He said, I thought that was a fair award. He said, because I was a very polite child. He said, I always addressed adults as sir and ma'am and always responded in the right way. He said, I tried to be kind to people and especially to those that were my elders. He said, so I thought I was a very polite child. He said, that was until on one occasion I asked my wife, how much do you love me? She said, I love you with all my heart, with all my soul, all my being. You are everything to me. He said, I don't need that much. He said, I only need 7 seconds. And she said, I don't understand. 7 seconds? He said, I've timed it. That's how long it takes to refill an ice cube tray and put it back into the freezer. Now, there's probably a half a generation of people here that you've never seen trays. It didn't always come out the door. You realize that. You used to have to twist plastic trays, and before that, you had to yank on metal trays. Do you remember those, to get ice put in your glass? But do you remember how annoying that was when you had somebody in the household, when you had ice trays, that would empty the ice? They just wouldn't put water back in the tray and put it in the freezer. So when you went to get ice, there was no ice. And that's what he was telling his wife. And he said, could I possibly be that petty? And he said, and the truth was, yes, I was. And so he acknowledged that he learned something about himself, because now he's married and he finds out that there are things that bothered him terribly about that. And so as we think about the marriage relationship, there are some things that we have to consider. What is marriage for? How would you answer that question? What is marriage for? God created marriage for what reason? Give me some answers to that. Absolutely. It was not good that man should be alone. So the whole idea of companionship, and even the word that is used there in the Hebrew, ezer, which means this helper, which is such a great word, because more frequently than any other entity, that word is used of God, not of woman. It's used of woman. She is to fulfill man in that sense. She is his helper. But God is our ezer. He fulfills all the things that are missing in us by our lives. And so he becomes the perfect complement. When we join ourselves to him, he makes our life what it's supposed to be. He said a wife the same way. Other things marriage is for.
Yes.
What's that?
Absolutely.
For the propagation of the race, so to multiply and to have children. And God gave us a means and told. Matter of fact, the first command he gave to man and woman was to be fruitful and multiply. And so the very first thing he told them was, that's a part of this whole relationship that we are forming. Other things.
Many?
So we never want to mention the one. We don't want to deal with the one side of God's creation. Iron sharpens iron, and how important it is that when we use each other that way and help each other grow, we become that fulfillment. And I help her become what she's supposed to become. And we'll see that if the Lord permits us to meet on Monday and Tuesday, when we deal with what is it that a husband is supposed to be doing? What is it a wife is supposed to be doing? How do we fulfill that and sharpen the other person to be what they need to be? Did he not also provide it in order that we would have a proper place for physical intimacy? I mean, he created us as physically intimate beings and provided a proper channel for that through marriage. And that's why he says that's an honorable thing when it's in marriage. God intended that we have a physical relationship as well as an emotional and spiritual relationship. He created it for all of those things. But that's not as much what I'm concerned about with this lesson as I'm concerned with the idea of what's the purpose of marriage. I mean, in other words, you're married. What does God want from your marriage? Because we live in a culture, I think, that so often gets things that aren't intended to be goals and puts them in the place of goals. I want you to turn to Matthew chapter 5. We'll get there in just a moment. Matthew chapter 5. But we put things in the place of goals that really shouldn't be in the place of goals. And I'll give you an example of that. It's interesting if you talk to Christians. You say, what's your number one goal? More often than not, you'll hear somebody say to go to heaven. That's their number one goal. I would tell you, I'm not sure that should even be your goal. I think that your goal should be to live the life that God has asked you to live. I want to be the most godly person that I can be. I want to imitate Christ in my life. And God says, if you do that, I will reward you with heaven. We're not striving for the reward. We're striving for what we're supposed to be doing. Even if we're running a race, the one who wins the race gets the crown, but he competes. He's striving to compete and do the absolute best that he can. And so sometimes we take the reward and treat it like a goal. Well, that's something that we understand. When we say that my goal is to get to heaven, we mean by that I want to live the way God wants me to live so that I can receive that reward. That's what most of us would mean anyway. But when we deal with marriage and other aspects of life, I think of our country. Think of our country, founding principles. We live in a country that is founded on principles like life, liberty, and what? The pursuit of happiness. And there's the problem. Happiness should never be a pursuit. Happiness should be a result of something. And so in Matthew chapter 5, when you start, that's not a passage about marriage at all, but it's very much a passage about goals and rewards. And so God starts that off when you've got this crowd that is there, and Jesus is going to be talking to this crowd, and he says, let me tell you something about contentment. Truly content. Truly joyful. Those that have real experience of joy and contentment in life, because that's not based on your circumstances. We know that. Jesus is described as a man who was full of sorrow, acquainted with grief. Is that an easy statement to understand about the life of Jesus? I mean, very easy to think of all the things that would have caused him sorrow, are there not? And you see Jesus weeping, not only over the way people treated him, but the fact that the Jews rejected God. I mean, all of that created great sorrow for our Lord. And acquainted with grief. Both physically, when he wept at the grave of Lazarus, he understood the pain and suffering that people go through and the grief that we feel, as well as spiritually. And yet, when he prayed in John 17, Jesus prayed that those that were his followers would have the kind of joy he had. And he said, and his joy was full, complete. Jesus, in spite of the circumstances, had a life that was content because it wasn't based on his circumstances, it was based on his relationship with God. So in Matthew chapter 5, somebody who's opened up there, just read me the very first one. Blessed are what? The poor in spirit. The next verse, blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are, you see what's happening here? He's saying, you want contentment? Let me tell you how to be content. If you have the right attitude about yourself, you're poor in spirit, you see yourself properly as to who you are and standing before God, how empty you would be without God, he says, you're going to be content because you know why? You're going to mourn over your sin. That's going to bother you, and you're going to want to seek after God, and you're going to have an attitude of meekness, and you're going to hunger and thirst after righteousness, he says. You're going to be a peacemaker. You're going to be pure in heart. He says, blessed are the people who are living this way. Well, marriage is that way. I'm not saying that marriage shouldn't bring you joy. It should, but you're not seeking your personal happiness in marriage. Think about this. Because this is the way so many marriages, including amongst us, starts out. It's like a romance story that you imagine, whether Disney has influenced that, or other movies, or culture, or whatever we've seen has influenced that. And a young girl meets a boy, and she thinks, wow, that is my Prince Charming. And she envisions him like he's that gallant warrior up on the hill on that beautiful white stallion, and he's going to ride down and lean over and swoop her up and throw her onto the back of the horse. I mean, she's got these visions of, I've finally met the man who's going to care deeply about me and be concerned about all of my needs and all of the things that matter to me and listen to me intently when I share my feelings. And then he drops down on one knee and drops that rock on her, and she says yes. And she finds herself pledging lifelong loyalty in a public setting to this man who is her Prince Charming. And somewhere down the road, expectations are shattered. Doesn't mean that the marriage isn't still good, but I'm saying we find out it's not exactly like we thought. And you find out there is real work involved in marriage. I'm going to have to strive for something. Happiness isn't just going to come. A joyful marriage isn't just going to come. It's going to require something. Men are the same way. We have the expectations beforehand, and then comes the work. I love a description that James Dobson gave of motherhood that said, this is how you understand expectations change. A young mother said she came into her house, and she said her three children and three of their friends were sitting in the living room in a circle, and she could see they were giggling and laughing and playing with something, but she couldn't see what. And so she said, as she got closer, she realized that the six children were in a circle, and there were six baby skunks in the middle of the circle. And so she yelled, "Children, run!" Each child grabbed a skunk and ran. She said it was at that moment that she realized motherhood is not exactly what I had pictured it to be. Well, we understand that. Expectations, what are they to be? Well, I think we have to get the right mindset first. We have to think in terms of happiness is not the goal. Not even here on earth is happiness the goal of marriage. The point of Matthew 5 is that you need to live a certain life. You want real contentment? You want real joy? God says, I can tell you how to have real contentment. Be poor in spirit and mourn and hunger and thirst after righteousness and be meek and gentle and peacemakers and pure in heart. He said, and when other people persecute you, just understand that's a part of who you are. That's a part of the game. Strive to be this person. He says, and I'm telling you, you'll be satisfied with life. It'll be content. The closer you are to the image of Christ and the closer you are thereby to God himself, the more content your life will be. So he says, first, we need to get the right attitude toward marriage. And so what we understand is that happiness is a byproduct of a life properly lived. So you want to be a happy married person? Be the husband you ought to be. We'll talk about that if the Lord permits on Monday night. But be the husband, Monday night. The husband that you need to be, and then on Tuesday night, the wife you need to be. He says, if you're the kind of husband you're supposed to be, and you're the kind of wife you're supposed to be, he's going to say, you'll have contentment and joy because you know you're doing what God has asked you to do. That's going to be the key of having the kind of life that God describes. And so it becomes the idea that happiness is the end game, not the pursuit itself. And we understand that because even as we think about life and think about marriage, what about this question? What if God designed? What if the purpose for marriage was not to make you happy, but to make you holy? What if God wanted to use your marriage, as was pointed out a minute ago, iron sharpening iron? What if God's purpose in marriage was to make us stronger, better Christians? What if he wanted to use my marriage to draw me closer to him and to help me have my wife draw closer to him? I think that's a valid question. What if God designed marriage to make you holy? There are things we're going to see as we get into one of the other lessons in particular, the one this evening, that we can learn about God based on our marriage relationship. And I think God wants us to do that. It's important to remember, romance as we know it, that's a relatively new pursuit. One of my favorite stories in the Bible is when Isaac was sent to find a wife, and he in fact is going to see her coming toward him, you remember in that story, and send his servant, and there's that whole description. Does anybody remember the description of her? How does God describe her? Do you remember in the Word? Rebecca, how was she described? Always love when God says something about somebody. You ever think about that? God said she was beautiful. I'm just saying. If God describes you as beautiful, I'm thinking stunning at the very least. Aren't you? Think about that. When God says, I've got a whole lesson that I do sometimes based on, what do you want on your tombstone? Not your pizza, your actual tombstone. Because think about this. If God could inscribe your tombstone with a statement that said, a friend of God, would you be happy? Man, I would. If God could put on my tombstone, if that's what he would engrave, a friend of God, Or if God put on your tombstone something like, there's none other born of woman that is greater, I'm thinking, wow. Wouldn't you love to have that on your tombstone? Or if God inscribed on your tombstone that this is a man after God's own heart, wow, how happy would you be? Well, God says she was beautiful, but the odd thing about the story is people think, yeah, no wonder he wanted to marry her. She was gorgeous. When did she remove her veil? You ever think about it? He didn't even know what she looked like. They went into the tent together. They were married. They were going to bring their marriage and consummate it together. Before she removes the veil, he didn't marry her based on some romantic feeling. He went seeking a wife that would help him to be godly, and that was what he got, and he was happy with that. We need to understand that has to be what it is we are striving for, and there's a reason for that. Because as you think about romantic love, you can't survive. No marriage can endure on romance and feelings alone. Why? Why can't it endure on romance and feelings alone? It's not permanent. There's one thing. It's not permanent. Feelings change, do they not? How many in here have multiple children? How many of you love all your children? I hope all the same hands go up. How many of you have had moments in your life where you were relatively close to the idea of, I can take you out of this world? You didn't stop loving them, did you? But I'm telling you, there are times that you don't like your children very much. They're behaving in a way that's not very pleasing. They're aggravating the life out of you. And if your relationship with them was based on how you felt only, there's no elasticity to that. There's no stretch to that at all. And so because there's no stretch, it's not going to last. You have to have something that is deeper than that. Well, when you're married, I've loved my wife. We've been married over 42 years. I have loved my wife, I think, every moment of those 42 years. But I'm guessing there's some things that she's done that didn't necessarily please me or make me real happy. And however many are on that side, I would tell you she's loved me for 42 years, and the list on this side is probably considerably longer. Things that I have done to annoy her, things that I have said, it doesn't take much. You don't even have to say anything. In our house in Kansas City, it was a tri-level, split level, what do you want to call it, but when you entered the house, you entered on the room that had the floor that had the living room, kitchen, and dining. And then half a flight down was a large family room. And that was where we gathered most of the time. And so we were down in the family room, and I decided, you know what, I'm thirsty, I'm going to get something to drink. And like the good, loving husband, I said, can I get you anything? Something to drink, something to snack on. She says, no, I'm good. Which always scares men anyway, because we're afraid she's going to, once we come back down, she's going to say, can I just have a bite of yours? And that just throws off our whole dynamic as to what we were planning. But I got up there to the next level, and I poured me a drink, and I got a little snack, and I closed the pantry, and right as I did and got ready to head back to the family room, she goes, you know what, while you're up there, could you go ahead and get me a drink? So I didn't say a word. I was standing there, and I just went, next thing I heard was, you realize I can see you. I didn't even have to say anything. But that's a rude thing to do. I understand that. That's an unloving thing to do. That's something that that isn't supposed to happen in a relationship. And if she stopped loving me because of something like that, that would be terrible, wouldn't it? But she wasn't real thrilled with that motion, I can guarantee you. If that's what it was based on, what about if your relationship with God was based only on his feelings? What kind of feelings does God have? You ever think about that? Give me some emotions that God goes through regarding us. All right, he's a God of wrath, and so no wrath if there's no anger, right? Possible to get God angry? Oh, absolutely possible to anger God. All right, anger him. Other things we do. He's a jealous God, and so we can get him focused on us, and so when we talk about our relationship with each other, that plays into that. We'll talk about that, but he's a jealous God. I can make God jealous by, if you will, cheating on him, placing something before him. I saw another hand somewhere. Other things. Can you disappoint him? Yeah, you can disappoint God. He hurts like we hurt when he sees his people not following him. So he not only can feel anger, he can feel disappointed in his people. Aren't we told don't grieve the Holy Spirit? God grieves over us. We saw the emotions of Jesus when he was here, just watching the people as he's riding into Jerusalem, and Jesus weeps over them. And that's such a great passage, because that particular description of Jesus weeping was not like at the grave of Lazarus. It really is a different word. It carries the idea of what we might describe as shoulder shaking, sobbing. We understand what that means, don't we? You've seen people that they're sobbing and they're just, I mean, you're crying. It hurts what you're talking about. That's how Jesus felt about the Jews, because they wouldn't follow him. It hurt him. And he even said, don't weep for me, weep for yourselves. He felt that kind of pain. We understand. So when Jesus and God have emotions, if our relationship with them was only based on emotion, how hard would that be? But it's not. It's based on other things. And so we understand we've got to have the kind of love that stretches. And so what kind of love biblically is that? Which biblical word would we normally say is the love that stretches?
Long-suffering
for one another? An unconditional love. We'll talk about that. And so the Greek word that we'd normally talk about or hear about is what? Agape? And so you've got this love that is not based on the other person's actions. And we know that because Romans chapter 5 tells us that Christ died for us when? What's the description in Romans chapter 5? Anybody remember? When we were enemies of God, while we were yet sinners, while we were yet separated from God, while we stood against him, Christ died for us. It was not based on how good I was doing. God didn't look down and say, wow, these people are incredible. They are doing so wonderfully well. I'm going to send my son. No, he said, in spite of the fact that they're doing everything they can to destroy everything about my relationship with them, and they're my enemies in that sense, I'm going to send my son to die for them. That's the kind of love that he's going to talk about that we have to have in marriage. And why is that so important? Because what we're going to see is two things. One, if you strive for happiness, you're striving for the wrong goal. We've already pointed that out. But I'll tell you, secondly, if you strive for happiness from the wrong source, then you're going to be going the wrong direction as well. So if I'm looking for my spouse to provide my happiness in life, why is that not going to work? I can't control that. And so who is going to provide my happiness in life? Only God can provide my happiness. Only God is never changing. Only God has a relationship with me that he will always be 100% consistent, and everything that I know about him will always be true about him. And so I can't, if I'm striving for happiness from my spouse, I'm striving for happiness, which is the wrong goal, from the wrong source. You can't get it from your spouse. And so for the last few minutes, I want us to think about this. Here's what God does in the scriptures. Throughout the scriptures, and we'll look at Ephesians 5 in particular, if he permits us to meet on Monday, where he talks about his relationship with Christ and the church. But we'll mention that this morning. But all through the scriptures, God uses marital analogies to describe his relationship with his people, Old Testament and New Testament. He uses a marriage to describe his relationship with his people. Why would he do that, do you think? Why would he pick that analogy to describe his relationship. Yes.
Most intimate, we know.
It is the most intimate relationship that we know, no question about that. And so we can learn something about that. It's interesting when you look at the things that God says. Marriage relationship is something I ought to be able to relate to as well, is it not? I mean, when you look at the parables that Jesus taught and the things that Jesus did by way of story, he used a lot of analogies, didn't he? A lot of different metaphors. Metaphors and analogies are only going to work if, what? If you're familiar. And so we struggle with some of them a little bit because of that. I mean, and somebody may help us understand better analogies that deal with sheep and shepherd and all that kind of, but we don't understand those at the same level that somebody who is a shepherd or raises sheep or lives in a culture that is absolutely every day to them. We don't even understand, typically, if we're removed a couple generations, my grandfather was a farmer. I don't understand anything about farming the way he did because I wasn't raised that way. And so analogies matter if they relate. Well, he says, so let's talk about marriage then, because our relationship is like marriage, and he's going to relate to that. And so there's some interesting things that he says in that regard that teach us some truths about God that he wants us to see. And that becomes important for us. And so he tells us things like in Hosea chapter 2, verses 16 and 19. It says, in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me my husband. You will no longer call me my master. He says, I will betroth you to me forever. My question would be, did God on that occasion cease to become their master? No, he never stopped being their master. He just said, I want you to think of me in a different way. He's still their master also. So why tell them, I'm your husband? Think of me as your husband. Call me husband, no longer master. Why tell him that? Yeah, faithfulness and unfaithfulness. It's going to cause us to think about the relationship, isn't it? A relationship with a husband is considerably different than a relationship with a master. Would you agree with that? And if any men are shaking their head no, then be here Monday night. Husbands are not masters. That's not what God says. He says, think of me as a husband. Think about our relationship in the church. You know, there's a reason that God uses the terms that he does. He says it's more than just a church, just a called out body, although that's the word we use most to describe ourselves, and it's the least descriptive. You ever thought about that? It just means called out of something. It describes a mob in Acts 19, the same as it describes us in other places, just called out of something into some other group. But he says, you know what? You're also a body. He says, I want you to understand. There's a reason he uses that term. It's interrelational. In 1 Corinthians 12, when he talks about hands and feet and arms and legs and eyes and ears, he said, I want you to understand how you're tied together in relationship. He talks about us being a family or a household together. He uses terms to help us get a better picture of who we are. Well, he does the same thing here. He says, I want you to consider me your husband. But I love this one. In Isaiah chapter 62, he says, I want you to get a picture. It says, as a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. I love that picture. Because here's what I get with that picture. I remember on our wedding day, over 42 years ago, we were married in a building, not as big as this, but similar to this in the sense that it had double doors right there in the center and the back. I was already up front with the preacher and the groomsmen. And at that time, the bridesmaids all came down. One of them that had a shoe that squeaked on every single step. So it gave you that relief you need at your wedding. But then after they were all down, Judy and her dad came around the corner and appeared in that door frame. Guys, can you remember what that felt like when you saw your wife? That was back in the day where you didn't see her that day until that moment. And so I thought, wow, that's incredible. The joy that you feel, the beauty that you see and that you sense, and you think, how lucky am I? How much has God blessed me that I'm going to be able to have from this day forward the rest of my life with this person? I'm telling you, it was just a joyful moment. God said, that's how I feel about you. Like a bridegroom rejoicing over his bride. God says, I want you to feel that emotion. And so that becomes important for us to understand. Think of all the other things that Jesus says. He describes himself as a bridegroom. He uses a wedding banquet to describe the relationship. On the negative side, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament, God frequently says that people are adulterous. You can't be an adulterer unless what? Unless you're married. You have to be married. And he says, but my people who are married to me are not being faithful to me. They are adulterous. Adulterous generations, he talks about. And so he uses both the positive and the negative side of that relationship so that we'll understand something. And if the Lord permits, tonight we're going to deal with just one thing we learn about God because you're married that I think is absolutely critical. And so this is the picture of divine reconciliation. When God says in Ephesians chapter 5, husbands, love your wives, and he gives all that description. He says, wives, submit to your husbands, and he gives all that description. You get to the end, and he reminds them again, but he adds a word in that last verse. He says, nevertheless. Because the verse previous to that, he said, you understand, I'm not really talking about marriage. I'm talking about Christ and his church. Ephesians 5:32 says, here's the mystery. I'm talking about Christ and his church, God's relationship with his people through Jesus Christ. He says, nevertheless, husbands, love your wives. All that I said is true, but that wasn't the main point. The main point was God is related to his people the way that we understand husbands and wives are related. And so he says, that's the picture of Christ and his church. And so we need to make sure that we understand why this is so critically important. We need to think in terms of not what's going to make me unhappy in life, but what's going to make God happy. There's the goal in marriage. What can I do to make God happy? How can I live my life so that God will be pleased? That's what Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5. As in all things, we aim to please God. That's the principle behind our marriage. How do I find God in my marriage? He has to be the focal point. And let me end by telling you why this is so important. Because we have three sons. And I say we for this example. Sometimes it's I have three sons. That was normally whenever I'd come home and I was told, do you know what your son did today? So I had full possession when they were misbehaving, apparently. No, we have three sons. And you realize everything that my sons understand about God the Father or God the husband is going to be filtered first through what they see in Mark as the father or Mark as a husband. I'm not saying they can't overcome that. I'm saying that's where it's going to be filtered first. You understand that? That's the picture they have first. And let me tell you why that's so critical. And everything they understand about reconciliation, they're going to understand about this relationship. What do Judy and I do when everything is not perfect? Everything they understand about faithfulness, all of it, everything they understand about my promises made are going to be filtered through what they see in our relationship. So let me just end with this story. I grew up in a home totally dysfunctional, which is one of the reasons that I chose to spend a lot of time devoted to marriage. Totally dysfunctional. You know, one of those descriptions where people say, if you looked up dysfunction in the dictionary, it would have our family photo there. Alcoholic, abusive at every level, physical, emotional, verbal, everything, across the board. The problem was, the kid down the street from me, who was a good friend of mine growing up, his family looked almost just like mine. And the kid across the street from me, his family looked almost just like mine. I remember when I got married, Judy said, I never heard my parents argue. I thought, I never heard my parents do anything but argue, yell and scream, and you could hear them from outside the house. My parents were yelling at us, whatever was going on. My father, I shouldn't say my parents, because my mother never behaved that way. She was incredibly Christ-like in the way she demonstrated her life, though we weren't Christians. And all of this is what I saw. And I met a guy, became close friends with him, and I went to his house, and his parents didn't act like mine. They were loving. And he tried to teach me the gospel. And I watched the parents react to the siblings, he and his sister, and that relationship was incredible. It was totally different than anything I had ever seen. And he spent 3 years trying to teach me the gospel. Judy claims sometimes I'm a little stubborn. I think he was just a poor teacher. I spent 3 years listening to him, and I knew what he was telling me was the truth. I just wasn't willing to give up some of my life at that point. I acknowledged that, and I knew if I was going to commit my life to Christ, I had to give up some of the things I was doing. And I wasn't willing to at that point, but eventually it got to a point where I said, what is causing their family to be who they are? Because whatever it is, that's what I want. And so it was less the words that he said than it was a demonstration in their lives of what marriage and family mean. And I'm telling you, the world is looking at our marriages, and somebody, if you live a godly life and a godly marriage, there will be somebody that is affected by that. And it makes a difference in people's lives. Most of you here know the gentleman that was that role in my life. That's Ralph Walker. We've known each other since we were little. We'll have time to talk a little bit more about that. But just to give you an example of why that's so important, and then the lesson is yours. We had a grandson born last year to our oldest son and his wife in Kansas City. And they named him Liam because there was some struggles in the womb, and Liam means warrior. And so they were concerned about whether he would be completely healthy, that kind of thing. And he was, and they named him Liam. But they named him Liam Walker. And my son wrote a note and wanted to make sure that we expressed to Ralph and his family that had it not been for Ralph's parents, who were godly and had an influence on Ralph, who was godly, who had an influence on me, so that I could have an influence on my son, who's now a Christian, he wouldn't even have been married to the girl that he's married to. They wouldn't have had the child they do, and so they wanted to name him Liam Walker to show that they understood that generations removed, their life was tied to a godly family here. It is critically important that we show the world God in our marriage. Thank you for your attention this morning.